From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the financial freefall continues for Detroit Public Schools.
They have an operating debt service of $56 million a year on a roughly $700 million budget.
What upcoming contract talks might look like as the UAW zeroes in on two-tier wages.
Given the amount of money that GM, Ford, and Chrysler have been making in the United States over the last 4 or 5 years, I don't see any way they get out of these negotiations without, frankly, coughing it up.
John U. Bacon on Michigan State's Final Four Chances.
Izzo be Izzoing is about right.
Plus, seeking diversity in tech fields with a hackathon for Detroit middle school kids.
You know, you can't dream about being something you haven't seen.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. For new ideas to flourish, for innovations to truly take hold and change our communities, we need to collaborate, right? Be more civil to each other. But exactly how do we do that? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the answer is easier than you might think. But first, UAW members gathered this week in Detroit to let local delegates vent and air their views about what the union should demand in contract talks with U.S. automakers later this year. Right in the center of the union's bullseye, the two-tier pay system in place for the last 8 years. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here. And Daniel, this is not in the least bit surprising to anyone, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, this was a pay scale that was put in 2007 and kind of suffered through the recession and on the other side came out and did what it was supposed to do, which was enable the companies to hire a lot of people and bring them in, and they brought them in at a lower wage. And it was really part of the comeback we've seen in Detroit. And now I think there's a lot of Sturm und Drang about the fact that they do exist, and companies, I mean, Chrysler's got 44% of their hourly workforce is working at a lower wage.
And as you point out in your piece for the Detroit News, this two-tier system is an affront to everything the union stands for. But then the reality is, without that concession by the union, a lot of these workers may well have had no jobs to go to at all.
Well, I think that's right, and we don't know where the companies would have been. And I think what's even more important is what some of their investment decisions would have been. I mean, we've talked on your show before about the state tax credit hangover that the state is now dealing with, this over $9 billion in tax credits that were mostly given out to auto companies coming out of the recession. Those were part of the decision-making process by the companies to invest in Michigan plants. So was, and so were, I should say, the second-tier wages. And they put all that stuff into the soup, as it were, when they make these investment decisions. And now there's a lot of upward pressure on the companies to close the gap and also give base wage increases to what they call the legacy workers. And given the amount of money that GM, Ford, and Chrysler, particularly GM and Ford, have been making in the United States over the last 4 or 5 years, I don't see any way they get out of these negotiations without, frankly, coughing it up.
Because the union certainly wants to regain that lost ground, but how does that happen without the automakers falling back into those same kinds of contracts that drove them into the ground in the first place, the ones that had them paying way more for labor than their foreign non-union counterparts?
You know, the companies got into trouble for a whole lot of reasons, and it's not fair to hourly workers or to the union to say, hey, it was all their fault, because it's frankly was not. And it's also important to note that their hourly workforce is, as a percentage of total workforce, is much smaller than it was before the collapse. So giving the kind of raises that they'd be talking about is less expensive and less costly to these companies than it would have been in the mid-2000s or certainly in the 90s or the 80s. GM and Ford particularly go into these negotiations about $10 an hour all in, more expensive than both Chrysler and Toyota and Honda in the United States. So there's going to be a lot of pressure on them to keep that gap at least where it is and not let it go large. And they're making near-record profits. Almost all the profitability of GM and Ford, for example, is coming from the United States. And when it comes to the UAW, the only profits that matter in terms of calculating profit sharing and anything else are what they do in the United States, not what they do in China or anywhere else in the world.
I have to throw this in, considering that we've got the talks opening up this summer, and the climate is different. Half the states in this country now are right-to-work states. So is the union in an overall much weaker position than in bargaining from past years?
Well, I think you could argue that. I've been getting some email traffic from some members that suggest that they're very much aware of right to work, and I think that they, at least this may be some locker room bravado on the part of some people, but they're basically saying that if they can't get the union can't give them the kind of deal they think they deserve, they would opt out of the union, and that would hit the union in where it hurts, which is in the pocketbook in terms of dues. So a lot of what's going on here is it's all about the money. You have to kind of follow the money, and not only the money that goes to members, but also what goes to the union, what kind of impact you're going to have on dues lines. When you're paying somebody less, fewer dollars an hour, the union gets fewer dollars an hour in dues from those people. So it's all a big pot of soup is the best way I can put it.
Yeah, a very interesting pot of soup that's going to be simmering through this year. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
10:07 Friday night. Spartan Nation's going to be glued to their TVs as Michigan State faces Oklahoma in the Sweet 16. It's MSU's seventh Sweet 16 in eight seasons. Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubagen is here. John, I have to open with a quote from ESPN's Myron Medcalf as he picks MSU for the Final Four. Here's his quote. Don't try to figure out how Michigan State does it. Tom Izzo be Izzoin. What else can you say about this Michigan State team? What else do you want to say about this team and Izzo now that you've seen them knock off Virginia and Georgia?
Well, that's about our man got that one right, obviously. I hope Michigan State fans appreciate what they're enjoying now because this is a unique coach at a unique time, to say the least. Of course, our man Nate Silvers, who correctly predicted all 50 states in the last election. 538 is his site. His staff broke it down for the best March Madness coach since 1984, I believe, since it went to 64 teams. And that answer is Tom Izzo. Based on the seed numbers of his teams and how many games they're supposed to win, in other words, an 8 seed is supposed to lose to a 6 seed kind of thing,
yeah.
He has won 45 games. He should have won 30 in the tournament. So he's won 50% more games, and he's stealing 50% more games than he should, which is an amazing thing. And how does he do it? Like, Izzoing is about right. I'll say two things, though, maybe three. One, he schedules always a very tough non-conference schedule, and everyone else does not, or
so
most teams
they're
don't.
Tuned up. They're toughened. And
well, you get
them
beat
up
in December. Yeah. Everyone says, wow, they're not that good this year. They say that every year. Mm. And then in March, you're not saying that because your time, you know, you've been tested. So you're a serious team. He recruits guys who can play in pressure games, obviously. And look, as far as being a game coach, who can manage his bench, manage the clock, manage the game situation, and get his team ready. I can't recall the last time I saw a state team come out flat in March Madness. Maybe I've never seen it, which is a heck of a thing to say.
Mm.
So he is, they say, the best March Madness coach. Got to give kudos to John Beilein, less experience in March Madness, of course. He is number 8 all time out of like 50 or so.
Now, I've heard this MSU-Oklahoma game for tomorrow night described as the one with the most thrill potential of any in the Sweet 16. What are you going to be watching for? What do you think?
Track meet, which means run and gun, up and down, fast break action, two-on-ones, alley-oops, not the usual slow it down, four-corner offense, you know, the zone defense and so on. It's going to be a lot faster than that. As predicted last week, Michigan State made only 20 of their 33 free throw attempts, which in a tight game is going to kill you if it comes down to 1 or 2 points there at the end. But it hasn't yet.
So far. Are you offering up picks for a Final Four?
I'm with the ESPN guy about Michigan State. It makes no sense, but there they are. Furthermore, by the way, if they win this game against Oklahoma, Oklahoma's a 3 seed, by the way, and of course Michigan State is favored, the number 1 seed in their bracket, Villanova, is already gone. So you're going to be facing an 8 seed in NC State or a 4 seed more likely in Louisville, but who knows, but not, you know, the elite teams you are going to face early on. So right now, Michigan State is about as good a shot as anybody leading in there. The other Big Ten team left, the only Big Ten team left, is Wisconsin. And they're still a 1 seed. They're still obviously very good.
You know, so here we have MSU is the first school to win 4 straight football bowl games while advancing to the Sweet 16 in men's basketball in the same 4 years. And meantime, in Wolverine land, a sad bit of sports history being made this year, something that hasn't happened since Richard Nixon was in the White House and gasoline was under 40 cents a gallon. Tell us.
Ooh, well, it turns out the last time Michigan was not in the postseason for football, basketball, and hockey was 1973 is the year you're citing there, of course. And by the way, that only happened because back then only one Big Ten football team could go to a bowl game, that is the champion going to the Rose Bowl. Were it not for that rule, you'd have to go back to 1968. I am four. I am no longer four.
Why?
Why? Because, look, what you decided there, Mark Hollis at Michigan State is one of the best athletic directors in the nation. And he did it the old-fashioned way, started out as a towel boy and worked his way up for three or four decades. He understands college athletics. He understands coaches. Four straight bowl games, four straight Sweet 16s. I'm going to say it. Dave Brandon was the AD in the meantime at Michigan, who did not do it that way. Had not 1 hour of experience in an athletic department before becoming Michigan's AD. Experience matters.
So, if you live and breathe the Black Ham, what do you do about March Madness? Do you swallow hard and root for the Spartans, or what? What do you do?
You start watching a lot of spring football. And spring football, people, is actually practice, by the way, to be clear. And you can't get in there anyway, but you get in the blogs, and who's been there, and what do you think, and who's the quarterback? Right now, almost all Michigan's focus, Michigan fans' focus, is on Jim Harbaugh and September. So that's how far away their hopes and dreams are.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon. As always, thanks, John.
Cindy, thank you.
It is Throwback Thursday. On our Facebook page, we turned up a map of the U.S. from 1946. It's supposed to represent the great folklore and myths of each state. What folklore represents Michigan, you ask? The famous winds. Really? That the best we can do when it comes to folk heroes and myths of Michigan? Minnesota gets Paul Bunyan, Kentucky gets Daniel Boone, South Dakota gets Calamity Jane, and we get the winds that occur off of Lake Michigan? Go to our Facebook page, Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Check out the map for yourself, and then you tell us what folklore or folk hero really, truly represents Michigan. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Collaborative, heart of the community, the next idea.
You need to be awake and take actions to make sure the things that matter to you and the impacts that you want to see in the world actually happen. And I feel like a lot of people don't do that.
We often hear we need to collaborate more, be more civil to each other, include more and different voices if we're going to get the best ideas to move Michigan forward. But we're often left with the question, exactly how do we do that? Our latest contributor to The Next Idea seems to have come up with an approach that's working in Ann Arbor. Omari Rush is curator of public programs for the Ann Arbor Arts Center. Omari, in 2013, you took it upon yourself to start what you call the SHUR series, S-H-U-R exclamation point. What is this?
Well, SHUR, just to start things off, is actually an anagram of my last name, Rush, and embodies the idea that I was hoping that friends would say yes to an empowered life in Ann Arbor, that folks who I saw wanting to leave, they wanted to go to other cities because they couldn't find a certain kind of job or a certain kind of life partner or a certain kind of inspiration. I just wanted to help them find ways to be able to create the life that they wanted.
What happens in SHUR?
For SHUR, we get together weekly for 4 weeks, and it's a group of 30 folks. We talk about what it means to understand your values and say yes to what's important. We talk about possibility thinking, the way the arts can stimulate that. We talk about what it means to be a citizen and impact your community. And we also hear from seasoned veterans of life who share examples and stories of times that they said sure to challenging situations and did so because it was important and felt really good about their decision today.
How do you decide whom to invite to these SHUR sessions?
I love pulling together very different, diverse kinds of people and just seeing what happens when they get together. So for SHUR, I end up working hard to mix people who I think have interesting stories, interesting backgrounds. Sometimes I'll do it specifically because I want them to meet someone else in the series. And then I also look for leaders in our community, folks who have lives that I've personally labeled as successful, and ask them to come in and share with us. Also folks who are just expert in their careers, whether it's financial advising or real estate.
What are some of the techniques you might use to get people who don't know each other and maybe who aren't used to being in and having community-wide conversations to kind of
get in and get involved?
Certainly in this group of 30, there's always assigned seating, and I am very intentional about who I place next to each other. We also are usually eating during Sure, and food always helps kind of lubricate situations. And then I'm just very intentional about games that we play, ways that I get folks to introduce themselves to one another and reveal different bits about their work life or where they live or what they're aspiring to achieve in life.
You have 162 alumni to this point from six Sure sessions. What kind of response have you gotten from these folks?
People are overwhelmingly and consistently really pleased with the series. They're pleased because they found it to be very inspiring and uplifting. They've found that it's really, I don't know, kick them in the pants as it relates to making certain life decisions, getting a new job or committing to a new relationship. And they've also found that it's allowed them to connect with resources in the community that have helped them do the kinds of things that they want to do. So whether it's financial planning or whether it's a mentor who's had a similar life experience that they now feel like they can go and talk to and get some additional advice.
They're walking away with names and numbers and email addresses. Now, you've gotten recognized from Governor Snyder for your efforts, but you point out in your Next Idea essay, these reactions say less about Sure itself and more about the desire for people to feel connected. What makes you say that?
There was a period that, you know, and it still continues, that I was continually meeting folks who were saying, you know, where are all the people who like this? Or where are the people that are trying to do that? And Sure has been able to bring those folks together, help people realize shared interests, and help them then work together to achieve common goals or be inspired by difference to achieve an unexpected goal.
Right, we want to talk about then how you take this model and take it elsewhere. First of all, how do you bring into the fold these people who maybe aren't active in their local communities, but you think would be good, but how do you inspire them to drop their fears or their self-consciousness and come play?
So I end up, I'll say recruiting, even though it's not that official for Sure, while I'm sitting at the bar or if I'm walking down the street and I am standing next to someone for just a little extra time, and then I'll just strike up a conversation and end up inviting them to join us. And it's those kinds of random people that make the group particularly exciting. And so it's been just really great to have those unexpected folks.
You're getting
involved.
People out of their silos.
Absolutely.
Now, for grassroots leaders in other Michigan communities, now that you've done this a little bit, what recommendations would you make to them for being able to bring this concept to their towns?
First, I would say Sure for each session involves 30 people, but that's just because it's a number that feels good and comfortable to me. But the spirit of saying yes to an empowered life, the spirit of bringing people together and having something special come out of that can happen with a group of five, it can happen with a group of 30 or a group of 100. And so I would continue to affirm the power of small groups and their ability to make change in a community and in the world. And for people to just realize that it still takes that kind of work at the grassroots level. It still takes one person saying, let's do this, and pulling people together, providing some structure in those interactions, again, intentionally mixing people, giving them ideas about ways that they might be better themselves or ways that they might be able to improve the community, and realizing then what resources they need to turn those ideas about being better into reality.
What have you learned through doing this?
I have been really inspired by the people that I've met and learned that our talent pool in this area of Michigan is extremely deep. I've learned that there is so much that I can do in this area because there are so many wonderful resources and wonderful people.
And the payoff for Michigan, if this spreads?
The payoff for Michigan, if this idea of convening creative, talented, smart people and getting them to stay in Michigan and use their talents here, the payoff is enormous. And it's the kind of thing that allows for new ideas to be generated. It allows for new innovations to come to life. And it allows for everybody just to lead happier lives.
Omari Rush is curator of public programs at the Ann Arbor Arts Center. You'll find his essay at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Omari, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
My failure. My failure.
My divorce.
I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore. I can't do this.
And now a story from Failure Lab from Detroiter Stephanie Christian. It's about the early stages of her career and the challenges of being a Black female rocker.
So this very famous and successful music publisher from New York came to see me in a little house on the east side of Detroit. And he loved my voice. He loved my songwriting. I was only 15. He thought I was great. But he was more intrigued by the fact that I sang rock and roll. And everything happened very quickly after that. He flew back to New York, and within a week or two, I was being flown to New York to write with some of the most sought-after music producers and songwriters. I was doing what I loved. And I don't want to say names, but like to myself at 15, being flown out to New York and staying in a fancy hotel, I was the ish. I'm not going to cuss. Everybody always had talked about how my voice was so deep and like, why do you sing rock and roll? And like, you're Black. And I always got I felt a lot of stigma towards me. But once I had talked with that guy and he started flying me out to New York and I was like, really, people were taking me seriously. It completely changed my life. So I was spending every high school break in New York. And it was on one of these meetings with the producer that I like met the one. I didn't want to work with anybody else. We wrote great songs. We made even better music. And everything just clicked. I knew that I didn't need to work with anybody else. So here is another person who is very successful that I'm meeting at such a young age, who took me seriously, who liked that I sang rock and roll. And it wasn't a gimmick, because I'm going to tell you, I can sing. So fast forward about 3 years. I'm going to New York every break, winter break, summer break. And then I make the grand decision after graduating high school valedictorian. After attending Wayne State University for a year and earning all A's, that I'm going to drop out of school and move to New York. Because that is what's hot. That's grandma. That's what I need to do. My producer convinced me to do it a little bit, more than a little bit. And of course, you know that when your parents tell you not to do something, fuel to the fire. So this just goes to show you how much my grandmother loved me. My grandmother did not want me to move to New York. At least finish school first. That was the furthest. When I went to school in the first place, I knew I didn't want to. When I graduated from high school, my grandmother bought me probably a 1988. It was at least 10 years old when I got it. She paid $800 for it. And it was my graduation present. And when my grandmother got tired of fighting with me about moving to New York, she bought it back from me for $800. So now, I'm 18, I signed to this publishing label as a writer because I'm the shit. I have this money, I call my friend who lives in Brooklyn. I'm like, yo, can I sleep on your floor? I'll pay you $100 a week. Really, that's not what's hot, is sleeping on people's floors. It's not, but I felt like, especially in regards to New York, that if I didn't suffer, whatever I earned, I wouldn't have deserved. And maybe that's my mindset, or the way I grew up, which I can't get into because we'll be here all night. So, I moved to New York. I have this $800, sleeping on somebody's floor. Of course, I had to work when I got there. I started temping. Was trekking from Brooklyn to Manhattan in these heels. I wasn't smart enough to realize when I saw all those ladies on the subway with gym shoes and suits on that that's what I should be doing. Nah, I wasn't that smart. Even after working a 40-hour work week, I barely made enough money to eat and sleep on somebody's floor. Somehow, and it was probably on my own, that I started to go to bars and people just let me drink. And that was okay, I was 18. That's almost legal. I met a bartender who told me, you know, you should take a bartending class. We make a lot of money, and I could see it. So I took a bartending class, started making fairly decent money, and I was able to get a place on my own. Had a really nice studio apartment, and I can't explain to you how those are some of the loneliest nights of my life. So I'm in New York. I'm not doing so much writing and recording anymore, and I don't really understand why. So first off, I'm going to tell you that the publisher who signed me and who was one of my biggest supporters quit. He tried to take me to the label that he worked at. He took a VP position at a label who catered to rap artists. They were not feeling this little black girl from Detroit who sang rock and roll. I remember marching into my publishing label after he left, and I never felt more like a redheaded stepchild, no offense to redheaded stepchildren. And I asked his replacement, I said, hey, yo, I just thought that it was going to be like a fluid continuation. She would take his place and care for me as much as he did. And I said, what's the plan for me now? And she very coldly looked at me and said, Stephanie, I don't know what to do with you as an artist. So you saying that because I'm black, I can't sing a certain type of music? This is your job, lady. This is what you're supposed to do. I didn't hear any part of the conversation after that. And that was that. I was done with that label. They dropped me. And all the while this is happening, fast forward of maybe a year or two, I don't know. I haven't seen my producer that much. He's been working with an already established artist who has a major record deal. I walked into his house, and I've known this guy for years. He's been working with this artist, I don't know, maybe say a month or two. And it's a big picture of him and them on the wall. I've slept at your house. We've known each other for I don't know how long. And you don't have one picture of us together. And I knew that something was happening. I felt a shift in our relationship, besides the fact that he just wasn't working with me. And he would tell me to hold on, and I would. There are other things that were occurring, but because of the sake of other people's privacy and even my dignity a little bit, I can't speak on it, but I just tell you that I've never felt so betrayed. I've never felt so alone. I've never felt so unimportant. And I've never felt so already forgotten. My whole plan was to take over the world, and I was just watching it slip like sand through my fingers. I did get to record with my producer again one time. I recorded a whole grand demo, but it hurt me to sing. Physically hurt me. Whatever we had before was gone. I decided that the damage had been done. I was going to cut my losses and move back to Detroit. Now, what I'm saying to myself right now is, I can't believe that I dropped out of school and moved all the way to New York to become a bartender. I was really good at it. And when I say bartender, I mean bartender, like Coyote Ugly bartender, like dancing on the bar and splashing people with water. I worked at one of the rowdiest spots in Manhattan. We were encouraged to drink with the customers. I swore like a sailor, and I screamed all night. One day, I opened my mouth to sing, and I couldn't. I had physically hurt myself. Came back home to Detroit. I went to go see an ENT, my ear, nose, and throat doctor. He said, oh, ma'am, you have nodules on your vocal cords. So you mean to tell me I did all of this to be the best singer in the world, and I'm a bartender? And not only am I just a bartender, I have nodules on my vocal cords and I can't sing. He told me that surgery was the only way to remove them, and there was no guarantee that I would sing like I did before or if I would be able to sing at all. When I got back to Detroit, there was such a relief that I felt. I'm the oldest of seven. I got to be back home with my grandmother and my siblings. But I felt so ashamed. I wouldn't take any phone calls from anybody. I had friends that were graduating from college. I had friends that worked on Capitol Hill. And I didn't even have a demo or anything to show for the 3 years I spent in New York. People say that, you know, experiences like this make you stronger, and God can't put on you more than you can bear. I say bull. I didn't do what I knew I could do. I hurt myself while doing it. trying to do it, I guess is a better term. And I've never, ever, ever felt so abandoned. Thank you.
Stephanie Christiane telling her story to a Grand Rapids audience. You can find out more about upcoming Failure Lab events and hear more stories at failure-lab.com. Still to come, the money miseries continue for Detroit public schools. And then, seeking diversity in tech fields with a hackathon for Detroit middle school kids. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Before its financial ship completely sank and the city of Detroit had to declare its historic bankruptcy, it was skipping its pension payments, trying to hoard dollars to stem the rising tide of red ink. It didn't work. And it's happening again, this time with Detroit Public Schools. As we learn, DPS is $53 million behind in its pension payments, and there is no end in sight for this financial freefall. Chad Livengood of the Detroit News is here with us. Now, let's start with the projected deficit this year. What are we looking at?
The district is projecting a deficit of $166 million. It's a little less than the $172 million last year, but it is spiked back up after they had a couple of years where they got in control of the deficits. They have an operating debt service of $56 million a year on a roughly $700 million budget. No other school district in the state has anything comparable. That's $1,200 a student that comes off the top of what DPS is spending, which is some of the highest spending per student, almost $14,500 a student in the state. That debt is a huge piece of it. And then the pensions, it's just like the last thing that gets paid. When DPS is trying to sort of hold on to money, make sure they have enough money to make payroll every 2 weeks and keep classes operating, right now they're projected to be at $81 million behind by July 1.
And as you point out in your story for the news, with interest penalties because of that of $7,600 a day.
Yeah, that's a little more than what the district gets per student in a foundation grant from the state. They are essentially losing, squandering, whatever adjective you want to use. They are losing this money every day in interest penalties. Then there's another $78,000 monthly fee for being delinquent, and that's the equivalent of a teacher's salary and benefits. We did this story because the coalition in Detroit that's about to unveil some recommendations to Governor Snyder on things they think that can be changed the way education is delivered in Detroit, because it's a very broken up system between the city school system, independent charter schools, the Education Achievement Authority. Thousands of Detroit students leave the city limits every day to go to school in the suburbs.
Yeah.
One of the things with Detroit Public Schools is that they're really saddled with higher costs for special education, higher than the average school district in Wayne County or suburbs or even the statewide average, because they have to take on every kid who comes in their door. And charter schools don't have the same type of mandate for servicing every need of a special education student, especially one who's very cognitively impaired. And so DPS has some really good special ed centers, and they're very filled school buildings, but they're very high-cost programs. And because of that, they are spending $40 million more on special education every year than they actually take in for those students. That's a big factor in that $166 million deficit.
And, Chad, as we talk about all of this financial trouble, we all know the Detroit Public Schools have been under state oversight for 12 of the past 15 years. They're on their fourth emergency manager in 6 years. Why in the world would any parent of a Detroit Public School student believe that this newest emergency manager, Darnell Early, could do anything to right this ship that hasn't been tried before?
That's what the coalition got formed over, because essentially community business leaders see that this is like the last big nagging problem for the city, is trying to get a stable school system or system of schools that can deliver education at an affordable cost and be stable and attract middle-class families back into the city.
And your story for the news, you have a quote from outgoing state school superintendent Mike Flanagan saying Detroit schools need debt relief from the state legislature. And what do you think the chances are that this new crop of state lawmakers would even begin to entertain that idea?
Governor Snyder, in his proposed 2016 fiscal year budget, included a $75 million line item in that budget for distressed school districts. And after some initial reporting we did on this, the governor's staff acknowledged that this money could be used to help the DPS, for example, with that $56 million payment. But the budget committees in the House and Senate passed budgets this week, and they largely gutted that request from the governor. The House took the $75 million back down to $4 million. I would look for this to be a big negotiation point in the budget talks, especially as the governor formulates a plan and submits a new plan to the legislature this spring on sort of a new deal for Detroit Public Schools, because he's basically said that the emergency management's not working.
So the next step is we're looking to Monday with this community-based coalition for the future of Detroit school children unveiling ideas. What are you expecting to hear from them, Chad?
The big idea that's been kind of been floating around for a while is some type of new authority over all educational entities in Detroit. And if that sounds like back to the future before we had school choice and charter schools, well, I guess we'll have to see what it looks like. But essentially, the idea is that some type of governing authority that can manage and rationalize where schools are placed and better manage things like enrollment. If you want to enroll your child in a school nearby and you try to apply to DPS or a charter, it's very confusing. You have to fill out multiple forms. Busing is a big issue. Charters don't have to bus. DPS does. And DPS is busing kids from all pockets and corners of the city. It gets more and more expensive, especially as the city is less and less populated. And then there's also just the general and more controversial issue of closing schools that are poorly performing. There's a lot of talk about some type of a mechanism that would allow some type of new commission or council to decide if a school is not living up to expectations that it could be closed. And that feeds into this ongoing debate in Lansing about the school reform office, which the governor just took under his wing a couple weeks ago from the Department of Education.
One's head spins. That's all I guess I can say. Chad Livengood's piece is in the Detroit News. As always, thank you so much, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
The focus will be on how to increase diversity in tech jobs as more than 100 Detroit middle schoolers gather this weekend for a two-day hackathon. It's put on by Ford STEAM Lab. It's part of the Ford Motor Company Fund and done in conjunction with partners like California-based Yes We Code and the Level Playing Field Institute. Sean Wilson is organizer for the Ford Motor Company Fund, and Kwame Anku is with Yes We Code. Kwame, let's start at the very beginning for those of us wondering what a hackathon is.
Sure. You know, a hackathon is an extraordinary experience where young people are able to come together with technology professionals to come up with their own mobile app ideas, to develop a prototype over maybe 2 to 3 days, where they literally go through a process of saying, hey, if I could create an app to change the world, what would it be? And then they've got a team of professionals that are working with them, project managers, technologists, coders, and developers, to create an example, a prototype of that app within literally 48 hours.
How were these kids picked?
Well, we did a great project in conjunction, obviously, with the Ford STEAM Lab and Detroit Public Schools, identified some schools and some teachers and some students and invited them to participate. We have over 100 that will be participating this weekend.
And these are youngsters who show kind of a flair for this.
Well, not necessarily. Oh. I mean, ultimately partnering with Detroit Public Schools, really selecting kids with high potential, below opportunity. Basically. And what that means is we have to first expose our students to technology, to careers in STEM, to tech entrepreneurship. You know, you can't dream about being something you haven't seen. And so it's all about the exposure. Kwame and I talk about that all the time. You know, first step is exposing them to it, getting them excited. But not just exposure, but really what we're trying to do is find their passion. Because you can't just walk into a classroom and say, all of you need to go into the STEM field. Although we know by the year 2022, there's going to be 1 million STEM-related jobs and no one to fill them. Right. So we have a dire situation here in our country where we need to feed those careers. We know that that's where innovation comes from the STEM field, creativity comes from. And so it's important that we feed that pipeline early. And in this case, it's starting as early as middle schoolers.
So it sounds, Kwame, like you're trying to flip a switch on.
That is exactly right. That is exactly right. And our, you know, Yes We Code was actually founded out of a conversation with the legendary rock star Prince and our founder, Van Jones. And they were basically, you know, very frustrated in the wake of the Trayvon Martin murder. And Prince had mentioned to Van, he said, you know, why is it that when you see an African-American kid in a hoodie, somehow you just assume that must be a criminal or a thug? But you could see a white kid in a hoodie and
like
think,
Mark Zuckerberg.
And think, that's Mark Zuckerberg.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
And he challenged Van. He said, just with your national standing and leadership skills, you should organize some type of movement to flip the switch, to be able to flip the script and change the iconography. And that's exactly what Yes We Code is all about, mm-hmm. so that all young people can see themselves as being pioneers in technology, entrepreneurs, and that they can be leaders in this technology space as well.
And that's really how, you know, these next 2 days really came about, is expose kids over 2 days to something pretty phenomenal. I mean, they're really going to get full-blown exposure to what it means to create your own app, to ideate your concepts. Design thinking is a part of this. You know, we want engineers, but we want engineers who are creative, innovative, who can think outside the box, who you can say to them, you know what, I know we're leading the industry with our F-150, but now we want to go all new aluminum body, make it happen. And they have the concept and the skills to be able to do that.
So this hackathon is really going to present real-world demands on these youngsters. And what's at stake? What are they competing for?
So they are competing for $30,000 in awards and prizes for their schools, as well as scholarships for education. So, you know, and I think one of the interesting things about this is a lot of times when you do hackathons, you pick three different areas to focus on. But in this situation, we picked education. So Michigan right now, you know, one of the hottest topics is education. We have an opportunity to get the youth voice. What would they do? What kind of app would they design if they could change their education, right? So we're going to hopefully come out of here with some really good ideas from the youth on what they would do to impact their educational future. And I think that's powerful.
Kwame, the Rainbow Push Coalition and colorofchange.org forced some of the big tech companies, Facebook and Twitter and Google and such, to reveal the racial makeup of their workforces. And 2014 data showed African Americans were about 2% of the labor force in the
That's
tech
right.
industry. What do you think is behind that lack of people of color in tech?
Well, Cynthia, I'm glad you asked. I think what's behind that is another number, another statistic, and it's that in 2013 – there were 11 states in the United States where not one African-American child took the advanced placement computer science exam. We have a profound exposure problem. And so this is what Yes We Code is all about. This is what the Ford's Theme Lab is all about. That's what the event is all about. I went to Stanford. I was down the street from the Google campus. I was there 2 months ago. Google is one of Yes We Code's partners. And when you go on that campus, it's extraordinary. It's like Disneyland. It's the epicenter of this, you know, mammoth technology empire. But it's striking that you see so few black folks there. But what that screams to me is opportunity, opportunity, opportunity.
Not lack of ability.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what has to happen, and I'll make this a jump ball question to either of you, academically for these youngsters now to level the playing field, if we will, but also to kind of prepare the ground in the companies as these kids that are going to be at the hackathon this weekend make their way through high school into college so that the doors are as open for them as anyone else?
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, Yes We Code has, you know, a three-prong approach to this problem. And we know it's going to take probably 5 to 7 years mm-hmm. working, you know, nationally to do that. What we're doing this weekend is what we call the first mile. That's the exposure, as we've talked about for the last few minutes. Mm-hmm. The second part is where you have to go deeper. It's an education transformation. And that happens at two levels. You have to have computer science curriculums throughout public education. That's a must. You have to be doing that the same way we're doing geography and mathematics. Has to be a part of the mainstream curriculum. In addition, there's these extraordinary institutions called boot camps. They're springing up across the country. The Dev Boot Camp, App Academy, the Flatiron School out of New York. They're creating 12, 18-week programs that are taking folks at, you know, 18, 19, 20 with no coding experience. And within 12 to 18 weeks, getting them placed in $65,000, $75,000 a year entry-level coding positions. So this is something that needs to happen across the country. And then the third mile is really at the employer's level. And this is, again, what Sean was alluding to. And we're working in developing an employer's council so that the major companies are involved on the front end of helping to design this pipeline so that ultimately you have the apprenticeships, the internships, and great employment opportunities as well.
Yeah, I'll just piggyback on that. I think it is about redefining academic success. Traditionally, right now, if you walk into any room and say, what's success in education? People are going to say graduating from high school and then going on to a four-year college. Well, in order to feed this pipeline and to meet the demand, we have to redefine what success looks like. And that success could be graduating from high school and going into a boot camp. That could be graduating high school, getting a certificate program.
And we're hearing that from Governor Snyder.
Absolutely.
That's echoing what he's saying. It is does not have to always be about that four-year
bachelor's
degree.
That's right. Obviously, I'm a big fan of universities, and mm-hmm. I think they play a very important role in our society and in our country. But ultimately, it's not for every kid. And we've demonized two-year colleges in our country to say those are for the kids who aren't smart enough to go to the four-year colleges. And I just disagree with that. that. It may be that this child, this student, found their passion for something. And so they don't need 4 years to figure out what they want to do. They know what they want to do. And so we need to draw the quickest line from where they are to that success. And that may be a 2-year degree or a boot camp or certificate program.
Kwame, there are critics out there who question the real impact and value of hackathons, 2 days to work on projects. How do you convince critics that this is not just window dressing?
Easy. They should come. You know,
I can show you better than I can tell.
Absolutely. You know, Van Jones, our founder, says all the times that we go into these events thinking that somehow this is just about transforming the children. The reality is it transforms the hearts and the minds of the adults that participate, witness, and make it happen. And that's also where our belief and passion comes from. When you see a young person, 13 years old, coming up with an app idea that no one had ever thought of before, we're getting calls from venture capitalists saying, can we invest into that app? See, something extraordinary is happening. And they didn't even realize that they have the hidden genius. They didn't realize they had the talent. And we're creating an environment to foster that. And I'll say this as well, Cynthia. I don't think, when you think about this conceptually, I don't know where else in the country we create an environment for children, high school or middle school, where we say, listen, if you had the power to create a business today, to create an app today, what would it be? And then all of a sudden they've got technology folks from Ford, from Google, top project managers working around the clock for 2 days to create their idea, to show them what's possible. This is something that the world has really never seen before. So to me, hackathons are extraordinary events, and they're also accelerators, because now that 13-year-old believes that he or she can transform the world. And when they go home, they are on a path for self-education, for connection, and they believe that they can change their world and that they have a track that they can run on to make it happen.
Sean, what's the larger message, do you think, to employers in Michigan from all of this?
You know, I think the largest message is we need to feed the pipeline early and often, not waiting to handpick the best of the best coming out of college, but really looking for that talent early on. No different than how sports teams, you know, they start eyeing kids as early as elementary or middle school to say this kid has the talent, right? Well, we have opportunity to do that same thing here, identify the kids who have the talent, nurture, mentor them, and help grow that talent. And you know, ultimately, I think the largest message is we have to go to where the future workforce is, which is in the minority communities who will become the majority. So we have to go there now.
Sean Wilson is with the Ford Motor Company Fund and kind of the organizer of this week's 2-day hackathon happening in Detroit. And with one of his partners is Kwame Ankou with Yes We Code. It has been a pleasure to talk with both of you, and I'm sure it's going to be a really, really energetic couple of days.
And I have a challenge for you. So a lot of people think that coding is very difficult. My 8-year-old does coding all the time on code.org.
Okay.
It's very easy. And so I would challenge you to go on code.org and write a couple lines of code and see how easy it is.
I will do that because I'm not even sure what that means.
There we go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Joe Lindstroth, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.